Buongiorno, buonasera a tutti quanti, ben ritrovati qui su Libri Oltre. Siamo qui con Oksana Semenik. Oksana è una storica dell'arte, ricercatrice, giornalista. Alcuni di voi la conosceranno anche per il profilo Twitter o ex Ukrainian Art History, di cui potete trovare il link in descrizione a questo video, che non è solo una straordinaria fonte di conoscenza della storia dell'arte ucraina, ma anche uno strumento per capire la storia dell'imperialismo culturale russo in Ucraina e aiutarci a decolonizzare la nostra visione, la nostra comprensione della cultura ucraina. L'occasione di questa conversazione è la mostra Colori spenti, organizzata dall'Ukrainian Institute e dall'inchiesta, e di cui Oksana è una delle curatrici, e che starà a Milano, al Centro Brera, dal 18 al 28 di novembre. In questa mostra si concentra soprattutto sui lavori di Lyubov Panchenko, di Polina Rajko, di cui parleremo nel corso della puntata. La conversazione sarà in inglese, ma come sempre sono disponibili i sottotitoli in italiano. Oksana, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
As I was saying in the introduction, I mean the opportunity of this conversation, of course, comes from the exhibition that we will talk about. But I thought that it would be interesting before we go into that to talk a bit more about your work in the sort of space of decolonizing our understanding of Ukrainian art, and at the same time reclaiming Ukrainian artists and art that have long been labeled as Russian. Can you tell us a bit more about that? I mentioned your Twitter account that is very popular and it's incredibly interesting, but you've done a lot of work also in museums and in trying to have the names of artists and their origin change. So can you tell us a bit about that and how that started and why is it so important these days?
Thank you for this question. I think it's all started from my Twitter account. I created it in summer 2022, before my fellowship in the United States and especially in Zimmerly Museum in New Jersey. So it was actually a surprise for me that so many people will actually subscribe on the account on the very first days. Like I got, I think, thousands of subscribers in 2 or 3 days. And most of those people, they actually were art historians, curators, I don't know, professors from the many universities around the world. And that's how I understood that this topic is actually very important and people want to know about what it is Ukrainian art and what it is Ukrainian culture. So later, my fellowship started in the United States, and the Zimmerly Museum is the big private museum with collection of Ukrainian art, Russian art, and actually art from, so-called post-Soviet republics. I don't like this expression, but so from those countries who were, part of the Soviet Union. And collection is amazing, actually. But I discovered that many, many artists were Ukrainian artists were part of the Russian collection. Some of them, they were just born in Ukraine, and then after some years of working and living in Ukraine, they moved or immigrated to Russia, for example, or to even European countries. Some of them, they, moved to, yeah. So what I was saying is that many of these artists, they had some connections with Ukrainian art, or they were Ukrainians, or they, for example, worked in Ukraine, or moved from other countries. Even that happened to Ukraine, but there were no mention of about this, which was strange for me, because when we are talking, for example, for some famous artists like, let's say, Pablo Picasso, everyone knows that he was born in Spain. He spent there his young years, and then he moved to France. But no one would ever call him French artist. He would be Spanish, right? And you can check it on, I don't know, some museums around the world, actually. So this is really strange why this is happening to Ukrainian artists, for example. Let's say Archib Kuindji. whom Metropolitan Museum in New York recently recognized as Ukrainian artist, but previously he was labeled as Russian artist. He only studied in Russia and worked for a couple of years. He was born in Ukraine. He was then, after his education in St. Petersburg Academy of Art, he moved back to Ukraine. And even in his landscapes, you will see, Ukrainian landscape of Crimea, Mariupol, etc., etc. So this is really strange why this appropriation happening to really different stories and really different artists who, for example, even had like some connections with Russia, but only for a couple of years. Very famous avant-gardian artist Aleksandra Ekster, for example. She was born in Poland. When she was two, family moved to Ukraine. She spent actually almost her whole life in Ukraine, but only because she lived in Moscow for 3 years, she labeled everywhere, and Russian art historians called her Russian artist, which is really strange. Yeah, so actually then I started to write to other museums and ask them recognize Ukrainian artists as Ukrainian artists. Many of them actually refused. They said but it was Russia at that time, but it was actually Russian Empire and Ukraine was colonized. And this is also very strange for me why those museums, they don't want to let, this Russian Empire from this artist, because, for example, we are not saying British Empire, talking about India when the country was colonized by Great Britain, by British Empire. So, but unfortunately, it's a very long process. And now I'm working as a researcher for Ukrainian Museum in New York, where, for example, now we have exhibition of Ukrainian modernism and Aleksandra Ekster. So I'm more concentrated on more deep research. So in this exhibition, we're not going to show some artists who were, for example, wrongly identified as Russian artists, but they also experienced this colonialism of Russia and the Soviet Union it's affected them, and they experienced this colonialism. And for example, Lyubov Panchenko, she was censored for a very long time because of her art, because of her Ukrainian folk motifs in her art, and because her political position, she was against the political repressions in the Soviet Union. Many her friends, for example, they were imprisoned, sent to Gulag, etc., etc., and she was trying to help them. So for many, many years, she was just forgotten because of her political position and because she wanted to, work with Ukrainian culture, with Ukrainian art.
And just to also explain for some of the people who are listening to us, the thing about this sort of reclaiming of the Ukrainian artists, it's quite interesting because we're not talking, simply about, someone was born in a place, in a given place that today is in Ukraine, then was Russian Empire, therefore they are Ukrainian artists, right? The work that you do has very much has to do also about the content of their art. Like if you look at their lives and what they were, the way they were talking about themselves, the language that they were using when they were talking about themselves, the motives and the subjects of their painting, you can tell they're Ukrainian. It's just based on the sheer fact that they were born in a given city, right? And that's why it's so, it's quite interesting that, there would be resistance against that because it's so obvious and so clear. And every time, you're right, every time someone pushes back against that, one could make, as you're right, the same analogy with, say, an Irish writer born in Ireland during, British rule of Ireland, or I don't know, a Czech artist born in the Habsburg Empire, you know, you wouldn't call him Austrian, right? You know, like it's just so obvious that you wouldn't do that, right? And I think this is very important to underline that it's not just based on, you know, sheer geography. It's based on culture, it's based on identity at a much more deeper level. Like it's a more correct understanding of their art, right? It's not just a, yeah.
Yes, of course. I mean, even when you're looking at Ilya Ripin works, he was working with Ukrainian history of Cossacks, right? He was very interested in this. For, you know, sometimes to create one work, he would connect to Ukrainian historians. He would make some expeditions even to like Ukrainian villages to look how, you know, how it actually looks like, to be more realistic and more specific. So it was important for him. And it's really strange, you know, to be blind when we are looking at his heritage, his art, and saying like, oh no, there is nothing Ukrainian in this.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. But on that thing, I think it affects also non-Ukrainian artists at times. I was thinking, for example, of if one looks at Edgar Degas' Russian dancers, right? Yeah. They're clearly not Russian. Like their costumes, their dance, their dancing they're clearly Ukrainian dancers. So if you mislabel it, you just also not understand what it prevents you from really understanding the art, right? And you know.
With Ukrainian dancers of the guy, it's actually a really interesting story because I was speaking with Metropolitan Museum to change the name of this artwork, and many people who against you know decolonization, they said like why to change name that was given by artists. But in fact, he did not give this name to those artworks because it's not only one, it's many of them. He created many of these artworks. He just called it somehow like dancers of orgies, something like this. So it wasn't even like a clear, you know, name to the artwork. But it's actually interesting, you know, to look at this, why, for example, so many people, they do want to see Ukrainian culture as independently Ukrainian culture and not like part of Russian one, because through the centuries, Russian Empire was building like strong connections with other empires, for example, with French Empire, and how actually Degas saw these Ukrainian dancers. They had some kind of like so-called Russian culture days or weeks or something like this, where many representatives of different cultures, they came to France, I don't know, maybe to Paris, maybe to some other cities. And they were, you know, it was kind of very strong cultural diplomacy, and cultural diplomacy actually works very well. For example, even to look at some recent big exhibitions before 2022, before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, you can see many big exhibitions around the world, around the Europe, you know, with some Russian artworks, but many of them were actually Ukrainian artists. Maybe some of you remember, or maybe some of you know, exhibition in Finland. It was big, very big exhibition of Ilya Ripin. And I think it was only once somewhere mentioned that he was born in Ukraine. And that's it.
Yeah, that it's very interesting. I think it's such an important work, this one that you're doing. And it's really remarkable. I mean, I think overall, you probably have had also, you know, we tend to talk about why people push back. But I think, you know, there has also been some success because if you now Google Russian dancers by Degas, the Wikipedia page is actually says Ukrainian dancers. So we shouldn't only paint it as a, you know, as a only tell the bad story. There's also like a good story of change.
Yeah. But unfortunately, it's only like small, you know, small piece of really big iceberg.
Yeah, of course, it is, but it's still important. And to talk about instead about the exhibition that will be in Milan in from the 18th of November. So as I mentioned in the introduction, this is mostly about two contemporary Ukrainian artists, Lyubov Panchenko and Polina Rajko. These are two very different artists. Lyubov Panchenko, someone who came of age and formed in the 60s and in the environment of Khrushchev thaw and of the 60s movement, a painter, a designer, a fashion designer as well, a dissident, as you mentioned. Whereas Polina Rajko, slightly older, 10 years older, I think, is a naive painter who didn't really approach art until late in her life, like in late 60s or early 70s, right? So yeah. Very different stories, but both connected by the impact that Russia's war in Ukraine had on Ukrainian culture. And that because of the works of Rajko have been lost, probably largely lost due to the destruction of the Novokakhovka Dam and the flooding of Rajko's home, where most of her work was. And on the other hand, because in the case of Panchenko, she was in Bucha during the Russian occupation of Bucha. Bucha was her hometown, and she died following the occupation of deprivation and hunger, right? So once again, you know, the subject of Russian imperialism in Ukraine kind of comes back in a different shape in the subject of the exhibition, right?
I think it's even, they connected not only because of, you know, Russian invasion and destruction of the culture, because, yeah, as you mentioned, Panchenko, she suffered from the occupation, but also her house was damaged by projectile. And unfortunately, some of her artworks were destroyed in house of her friends that also was in Bucha and was completely destroyed and burned down. And with Polina Rajko, she died in 2004, but her artwork, it was actually her house, which is also very interesting because, for example, with Lyubov Panchenko, we can show some artworks. And thank God she gave, like months before the full-scale invasion, she gave her artworks to the 60s Museum in Kyiv. And that's why we have these artworks and they are not, you know, destroyed or not taken away. And it's in, you know, fine condition, etc., etc. But with Polina Rajko, she never created any like painting or maybe like some graphic work or illustration, because yes, you said she started to paint when she was 69, and it was I think in 1998, and she died in 2004. So everything that she created in her house was actually created between those years. And after Kakhovka Dam was destroyed in the summer of 2023, in her hometown, Oleshki, it's still occupied. So we don't know how actually bad destruction was. I mean, we had some videos from people who lived in Oleshki, but as far as I know, they also moved after this catastrophe. So even if we had chance to preserve some frescoes in her house, we couldn't because we don't have access to that. And of course, I don't think that people would try to save these artworks because it would be dangerous. Because everything, if you're in the occupied territory and you somehow connected to Ukrainian culture, it's dangerous. It's actually, I remembered the story that was more popular. It's about Maria Primachenko. She's a famous artist born in village Bolotnya, close to Chernobyl. And in the very beginning of the war, it was of this full-scale invasion. I think it was like second day of the full-scale invasion. Her museum in Ivankiv, regional museum, it was totally destroyed by Russian projectile, where first it was projectile and then it was huge fire. But some people who lived in Ivankiv close to museum, they managed to save 16 artworks of Primachenko, and they hid all those artworks in their houses. And then, I mean, during the occupation of Ivankiv, it's a Kyiv region. As I said, it's very close to Chernobyl. It's like 10 kilometers, I think, or maybe 15 kilometers to Chernobyl exclusion zone, which was also occupied. So everyone thought that these artworks were completely destroyed, but thank God those people were saving them. And after the occupation, they said, like, look, we saved these artworks. And it was really, it was amazing. And it actually shown how Ukrainian art, how much Ukrainian art, you know, value to Ukrainians and to just ordinary people. So that was a, you know, lucky story. With Polina Rejko, it wasn't, unfortunately.
Well, also because, of course, the main problem was that it was her house. Like the paintings are all on the walls of her house, and it's just when you have a flooding of that kind, it's probably even impossible to save them. And the other thing that we should underline, I mean, you mentioned it, but I think it's very important to make people listening to us understand that it's like the amount of risk that is involved in trying to save that work of art, because of course Russia's war on Ukraine is war on Ukrainian culture as well. And in the case of Rejko, whose town is in, for those listening to us, is in the region of Kherson on the left side of the Dnipro, so in still an occupied territory. But also one of the main artists and curator in Kherson and huge champions of Rejko's work, Vyacheslav Mashnitsky, was disappeared right during the Russian occupation, and we still don't know anything about what happened to him, right?
Yeah, it's actually what I'm trying to, you know, mention all the time, because it's also important that, for example, usually when we are talking about danger for Ukrainian culture or art, people would think about, something physical, something like museum or maybe artwork, or maybe like with Polina Rejko, it's the whole house. But unfortunately, we're also talking here about people who still live in Ukraine and who actually they are in danger. And for example, when we're losing our artifacts, our art, it's bad and it hurts, but we're also losing people who would, you know, who would be future of our art and culture. And I'm talking not only people in the occupied territories, which is of course important to remember, but also about people who fight in front lines. And there are many artists, writers, poets fighting in the front line. And maybe some of you, some of people in Italy heard about Victoria Amelina.
Yep.
She's a poet, and she also was a, she documented many Russian crimes in Ukraine, and she was killed in Kramatorsk by Russian missile. So you never know what can happen, and we are also not, yeah. But also, I think when I'm talking about this, and talking about like Ukrainian art history, for example, I also want to say that it's not just started like 2 years ago, for example. It started very, very long time ago. And even when we were talking about Soviet period, for example, in 1937, like thousands of Ukrainian writers, poets, artists, they were just killed because they were Ukrainians. And it's actually a story of this like killed young generation It's not only happened in Ukraine, it's also happened in Belarus, in Georgia and Armenia, at least, is at least that I know. But also, yeah, so when people sometimes can say, oh, but show us your Ukrainian great culture, because we know so-called Ukrainian, so-called Russian great culture. But many of these people, they were just killed and art was destroyed. So that's why we can't show many of these artworks. And that's why, for example, we, you know, can show on this exhibition only photos of Polina Rykos' house.
Yes, and actually you mentioned Victoria Melina. We did do an episode on her like a few months ago, so whoever is interested in catching up with that, we will have that in the description of the episode if you're interested in looking into that. And you're right, the war against Russia's war against Ukrainian culture is not just, you know, the physical destruction. You know, there are many layers to it. There is the physical destruction, right? But there is also the killing of people who would produce their art, and also the fact of putting, you know, the country and people in a situation where producing art is harder and harder. So it's not just that you destroy the artist, you also make it harder to produce art. And therefore, like, there is like a, you know, a miss, you know, these years are, you know, there's a cost just to the fact that you couldn't produce art for years. It's not that art is not being produced in Ukraine today. Of course, it still is during the war, but of course it's not the same. If you think of something like cinema, for example, well, they're outside of documentary, it's very hard to make films, right? So it's all encompassing, right?
That's true, but also, you know, but also I think it's kind of our resistance to create art even during the war.
Yeah.
And also, for example, why we chose such name for the exhibition is because even when those artists, they had, you know, like the most tragic life with repressions, censorship, living during totalitarian rule, etc., etc., they still created very colorful artworks. And because they wanted to share, you know, to bring to this world something nice, something colorful, something, you know, impressive. And they had this resilience and resistance to create such artworks. For example, even with Lyubov Panchenko, she was hiding those artworks for many, many years. And she was creating them so it's like a collage with wool textile, four coats. She was working on some factory, or someone would bring like this coat textile, and she would just, you know, take this pieces of textile from, what just had left. So she was collecting these colors. She was maybe something she was painting somehow. And that's how she created all those artworks, because she also didn't have money for paint, for example, for like paper, for maybe, you know, watercolors and something like this. But she was working in design, in fashion, and it was her passion to create such designs. And what's interesting that she was, I think, one of the first artists who would mix Ukrainian folk art and traditional kind ornaments, embroideries to contemporary modern clothes. And it was super interesting. But she just didn't have opportunity to create, to be free in her art, you know? And that's also, like, I think the problem with when we are looking at Ukrainian art history, we are forgetting that for many, many years, it was forbidden to create something except for social realism, which, you know, was actually just a Soviet propaganda. So those artists who created something like this, they were usually hiding it. And it was, you know, they could just, like, forget about it, just let it go. But they decided to preserve this art and continue to work with it, even during night, even during, I don't know, like some secret special time.
I think that one interesting thing to say about Panchenko's story, and then we'll talk about Raika as well, but about Panchenko's story is that her story, of course, is not also an isolated case. It's like it's part of a movement in the 60s, right, that she was very much part of. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I'm not sure how well-known it is to an Italian audience, and I think it's incredibly interesting and fascinating. So how does she kind of fall inside this artistic, dissident, intellectual movement of the 1960s?
Yeah, this is actually really, I don't know, it upsets me because many people, they know about dissident movement in Russia, for example, during the 60s or the 70s, but Ukrainian movement is still like unknown. So I would say that I would start, I'll continue my previous answer, because so imagine the situation when you can create something only in social realism style. Imagine that you have friends or you have family members who were killed during the repressions of 1937, then Second World War. So you don't have many opportunities to, you know, create something special, but at the same time, Stalin is still in the power. So everything is very, very strict, actually only about like propaganda, etc. And then Stalin dies, Khrushchev came to the power, and kind of the situation have this, you know, and I think you kind of starting to believe maybe in the bright future or something like this after such totalitarian and ugly person in the power. So this generation, they were born between 1929 or 1930, I don't know, 6, 5. So they were just too little to remember repressions. Then they survived Second World War. And then when they entered the university, new epoch began. And when I was reading a lot of letters, some interviews of artists of the 60s, it's very common thing that they started to think who they were, like who they are, you know, are they Ukrainians? Are they Soviet people? If they are Ukrainians, then what is Ukrainian culture? How it looks like when everything is the same, for example, because, you know, the Soviet system, it was trying to make everything, look familiar, look the same, and just to create like some new Soviet reality and new Soviet, I don't know, even nationality. And of course, it was only Russian language, for example, and Russian culture was over everything, over other nations. And it's interesting that they started to rediscover their culture. It's that they started to travel around the Ukraine, for example. They started to recreate Ukrainian traditional celebrations of Christmas or Easter. And I remind you that in the Soviet Union, religion and celebrations like this, they were forbidden. Also, for example, they started to go to the villages and discovered Ukrainian folk art and folk culture. Because in the official level, Ukrainian culture was something that we call Sharovary, Sharovarshina, which means that it was like artificial construct of, I would say, Soviet, not even Soviet, but how I think Russians and people in like Communist Party would see and imagine what is Ukrainian culture is. But of course, yeah, and then they created, for example, Lyubov Panchenko, she was part of Creative Youth Club. It was a club where, I don't know, writers, poets, artists, and just, you know, students, they would gather together, you know, celebrate Christmas, celebrate birthdays of Taras Shevchenko, direct some like playwrights, etc., etc. So it was amazing, amazing atmosphere of art, of some creativity. And then it became, and then the Soviet government started to see this as a threat. And they started to arrest people for this, for speaking Ukrainian, for, I don't know, celebrating Taras Shevchenko's birthday under his monument, etc., etc. Because I think they understood that if, you know, people would start to think about what, like, who we are, if we are Ukrainians, that what our culture looks like, what our true history is. So they look at this as to like some separatist movement, for example. But also, one of the key points was that they started to work on Bykivnya cemetery. It was not even cemetery, it was like a forest, Bykivnya forest, where a lot of actually those poets, artists who were killed in 1937, they were buried there. So they started to like investigate what happened, who those people were, and you know, and it was a very dangerous thing to do in Soviet Union, to try to look for a truth and look for what actually happened. Yeah, so I think you know, this like amazing creativity movement, it was just until 1965, and then first arrest happened, and then everything was under censorship. But again, they were, you know, fighting for their friends who were in prisons, in Soviet prisons. They were trying to help them somehow, and they were, you know, they started all this like civil rights movement. But I think also the other key point, like event that, you know, was really harsh for Ukrainian art society, for them, for this Creative Youth Club, is when Alla Horska, she was one of the leaders of this the 60s movement, she was killed very brutal in 1970, and it is believed that KGB did that. And it was even forbidden for people to come to her funeral, which was also crazy, like, because they thought that her funeral would turn to some revolution or protest or something like this. It's a very short history of this, very short, you know, explainer what was going on there, because it's really hard to explain this only in a couple of minutes, of course. And, you know, because even when I'm mentioning like some surnames and names, it's still, they're really unknown, and you just need to, I think, discover it by yourself, maybe Google somehow. Some names, at least like Alla Horska, for example, or poet Vasily Stus, he was also in prison and died there, actually. So,
well, those who follow us may remember that a few months ago, we published on the website actually an article on the exhibition of Alahoska's work in Kyiv. And there is actually, I'll add that to the description of the video, so you can find that and read it again if you haven't, or read it for the first time if someone hasn't read it already. And the thing you were referring to, once again, I'll specify for those who are listening, about the Bekivnia graves. These are mass graves that are just outside of Kyiv, and where tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people have been buried after being killed by the NKVD. And they were discovered in the 1960s by three of these artists, one being Alahorska, as he said, and the other being Lestanyuk and Vasil Simonenko. And we talk about that in the article as well, and hopefully we'll talk about that more in the future. But again, most people probably are not familiar with this, and it's very important to talk about it. And moving to Polina Rajko, I was less familiar with her work than in this case. And one thing that struck me, but I could be wrong about this, is that she had a very difficult life in a different way. She wasn't a dissident, but it was someone who was deported to Germany during World War II, then came back to Ukraine. She had a very difficult family life, with all of her family dying before her, and her husband and son's life being ruined by alcohol. And she starts, it almost looks to me as this, her art is one way to cope with trauma in a way. I don't know if that's my probably reading of it, it could be wrong, but I couldn't help thinking that in a way.
It's actually true. I think you're right, because in her very, very rare interviews, she said that when she paints, she forgets about everything. So I think it was really art that, you know, helps to deal with trauma, especially, you know, that she started, as you mentioned, paint in 69 years. After her husband died, also her son died, but before that he was for 2 years in prison, I think. And also her daughter died in a car accident. And yeah, she has a kind of different life, but also she suffered from, you know, this colonialism and the Soviet system in a different way. Because also in these interviews, she mentioned that her life was really hard because she was working since she was a kid. And because Oleshki was kind of city, but very small one. So it was maybe more like a village, and she was working in the collective farm. And collective farm, it was forced labor for Ukrainian peasants. And until 1960s or even 1970s, I think they didn't even got paid. So they were paid by some, imagine, I don't even know, working days, it's called. And for example, and also until 1970s, Ukrainian peasants, they didn't have passports. So it was forbidden for them to have passports. So they couldn't move to the city from the village, for example. And they couldn't start, you know, better life, actually. And that's why Holodomor, famine in Ukraine in 1932, 1933 happened. Because when these collective farms were established, people, they didn't want to go to work for nothing. Because it was, you know, no one paid them. And it was really hard because it was huge, you know, parts of land. And they didn't have like some, you know, they were working just by their hands. And it was really hard. And my whole family is from the village. And my great granny told me all the stories, how she was forced to work during the famine in Ukraine, because she just wanted to, you know, to live, to have some food. And she was 8 years old. So she started work on the collective farm when she was eight. So how this all the famine started, and it was artificially created by Stalin. They just took all the food from the peasants, and they just starved them to death. And if you wanted to survive, you had to go to this collective farm. So, and after this, you know, it was also like very hard. Years and years of working on the collective farm. So I think it's also interesting that we have in this exhibition like two women with kind of different stories. But Panchenko, she was also from the village, but she had this opportunity to go to study to Kyiv for embroidery worker or something like this. Raiko, she didn't have this opportunity to go study somewhere. And yeah, you were right that that art was actually her healing trauma. And for example, some symbols from her house, it's actually something, I don't know, I call, you know, her artwork, her house, it's like a paradise, and at the same time, it's hell, you know, and it's reality at the same time. So it's like the whole universe of Polina Raiko, because, for example, this three, usually people call them three owls, but they actually like leopards. Is that the word, leopard?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's from the Soviet carpet. And for example, some other works that she created, like four, like women. It's actually her, and it is she and her three sisters. So she created like. There's many, many symbols around, and it was her whole universe. And also as some kind of small devil, she painted her husband who were drinking vodka or something like this. So, and he was dead already. So I think it was kind of this, you know, hell, paradise, reality, something in between. That's why she's so interested. Unfortunately, I never had a chance to visit her house, which is really sad, really, really, because you can't see all these things and you can't feel the atmosphere looking on the pictures, right? It's really hard. Yeah. And that's why, for example, it's also, I think, hard to explain for those who never been there why she's so important. Why, like, so many people from Kherson region and from all over Ukraine, they were coming to her as it was some kind of, you know, religious mission, religious place to come, for example.
Yeah, I think that's important to say, like, her house had become just almost, even after her death, had become a place where people would go to, like, almost like a pilgrimage, right? Like somewhere where you go to a meeting point for artists and intellectuals and people interested in art, even after death. There aren't that many pictures of her that I found, but I did see a couple of her with some of the people who are visiting it. And I think it's very interesting in a way, and it kind of occurred to me while during this conversation, that in a way, what these two, the juxtaposition of these two artists, what it does is that in the case of Panchenko, you have, you have sort of like the still not known enough, but more evident, let's say, sort of Soviet kind of oppression and persecution, right? The one of dissidents and so on, right? But with the Reichel one, you have this something that is much harder to put one's finger on, which is this level of trauma and impact that the Soviet way of life had on people. And that is, people are still carrying in their lives, you know, decades later. And then it's very difficult to describe in simple terms, right? It's something that you notice when you read stories and you see how maybe people behave and they talk. And it's much deeper, and it's a psychological almost trauma, right?
That's true. And, you know, it's like funny when, for example, about some Ukrainian artists who were born in a village and they were self-taught, let's say, I don't know, lesser known Katerina Bielokur, but she's an amazing artist. She can be compared, I don't know, to Serafima Louis or maybe to Georgia O'Keeffe. She was painting like still lives with flowers, and she was totally self-taught. And some people saying like, oh, she was so lucky. She lived in the village, so she never had like political impact on her life. And then I'm asking, so tell me, Holodomor, artificial famine created by Stalin to kill, you know, and to oppress Ukrainian peasants. Is this political or it's not?
Yeah.
And it's, when we are talking about art history or even some, I don't know, just about people's stories, you can't say it's apolitical or it's something beyond the politics, because your daily life is actually affected by politics, right? And I'm saying it's in general. Like, for example, if you have opportunity to go to study to the university or not, if you have enough money to, I don't know, create art, to paint, to buy brushes, to buy paper, etc., etc. This kind of the same thing with this Ukrainian artist from the village, for example. They didn't have much opportunity to create. And it's actually interesting that Reiko, she started painting after she went on, she stopped working, and it was independent Ukraine. And I can tell you many, many stories of like some artists, they started to create like more interesting, for example, artworks after the independency, because finally they were, you know, relieved to express their feelings, to create art in such styles as they wanted, and et cetera, et cetera. And you're really right that it's hard to explain to people who never experienced like communism or post-communist trauma, how it affects people on everyday basis. And for example, I feel ashamed when I'm throwing away like some bad food, for example, because my great granny told me about Holodomor. And my granny also, she was born in 1944. So she also suffered from this like post-war, you know, post-war times. And it's crazy. Actually, you know, I remembered one story about an Italian woman. I met her in the US when I had my fellowship. She lived, she was like my neighbor. And when she heard that I'm from Ukraine, and of course she knew what was going on, and it was like summer 2022, she was like almost crying, because she said, oh, I was 5 years old and I remember Second World War, and how we were, you know, hiding on the basements and all the bombings. And she had to immigrate with her family to the United States because her house was destroyed. So I think it's, I think all this like stories, personal stories, they're connecting people, and we can understand each other just when we, you know, talk about it. And we have some common experiences. I mean, even if someone would live in Europe during some period of time, and we would live, you know, in Ukraine, in the, I don't know, Soviet Union, Russian Empire, whatever.
Yes, and I think maybe actually this is a good intro to my last question for you, which is about, as we were saying, in, you know, we were chatting a bit before recording this episode, and we're talking about, you know, how do you, you know, the importance of having, you know, people in Italy who go to this exhibition and in other countries learn about Ukrainian art, because one way of learning, when you know something and you understand it and you recognize it, then it's also, you're almost also more likely to support it, right? Like, you know, it's if when the truth is that when the full-scale invasion began, for so many, Ukraine was a complete terra incognita, right? No one, a lot of people didn't know anything about Ukraine, and so it's very hard to relate and to support and to help someone that you don't know, that you don't know that much about. So I guess my question would be about this exhibition, and, you know, what do you think that people who are going to go to this exhibition or want to go to this exhibition should take away from it, and why is it so important?
You know, it's a very hard question, because I don't want to be that person who would, you know, say, you should have this idea after you'll see this exhibition, you know, and you should spread the world.
Of course, again. No, I know, but
yeah. But I think it's important that for us as curators and team of this exhibition is to show that even, you know, despite all of this tragic stories, tragic moments of our history, we still resilient. We still have, you know, we still want to create colorful and bright art. We still want to share this culture with the world, you know, as with Polina Rajko, who would just, you know, she could be just sad granny and never created anything, but she had this passion and she decided to do it despite everything, maybe despite her depression, we don't know. With Panchenko is the same. Despite all the censorship, and that she never shown almost, like, except for her friends, her artworks, she were very, you know, she had this power to create artworks. And I think it's also kind of message to the world that even when we live through tragic times, we should still have hope. We should believe, we should, you know, create, and maybe art will help us to understand each other. And it's kind of this cultural diplomacy. And I think it's why it's so important. Because also in the media, for example, usually you can read only like some political statements or some news about the front line. But it's also important to hear personal stories, to hear, you know, how, just personal stories. And that can happen to everyone. Everyone, unfortunately, especially with climate changes and ecological problems, can be, you know, can have this experience with flooding, for example. Even like a couple of days ago, right? It was in Valencia in Spain. And people, you know, they have damaged houses, they have, you know, destroyed cars, streets, etc. So yeah, and I think it's also about preserving cultural heritage and how we should, you know, we shouldn't be so relaxed. I think how a lot of people are, actually, especially when I'm talking with them in Europe, and they say, oh, war, it could never happen. It could never happen to us. Like, we shouldn't think about, you know, how we will preserve our cultural heritage if something happens. And it's strange for me, because of course we should believe in better, but prepare to the worst.
I think that's a very good note to end on. And yeah. I think that, yeah, I would like to remind those listening to us, the exhibition, once again, is Colori Spenti. It will be, I'll say this in Italian because it makes more sense, sarà al a Milano, al Centro Brera, in via Formentini 10, dal 18 al 28 novembre. Credo che la puntata di oggi possa aver aiutato a capire perché sia importante andarci e perché sia molto interessante. Oksana, thank you so much. It was a really interesting conversation. I'm sure everyone listening to us will agree on that. And thank you, really.
Thank you for listening. And yeah, I hope everyone will come to the exhibition.
Me too. Thank you.